It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Jane Miller's in her first year as president and CEO of the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy, succeeding the founder of the Parks Conservancy earlier this year. We're going to talk about the current status of our city's parks, their future. Jane, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm thrilled to be here.
All right. For those who aren't aware, you came to Pittsburgh after being head of Minneapolis Parks and Recreation Board. What lured you to Pittsburgh after the great success that you had in Minneapolis?
The opportunities here. Running an incredible system of parks in Minneapolis gave me a great experience. And, you know, the work that Meg had done, Meg and I have been friends for about 4 years. I knew what she had done and I knew what she was trying to do. I also am very aware of Pittsburgh and its climb out of its deep economic recession and really exciting things that are happening. So being on the ground level of a city that's building up and you know, I'm a firm believer that urban parks are critical to the success of a city, particularly in today's world, to get the best and brightest to want to live here, create the quality of life, have parks be an integral part of what the city is in the future. So That's why I came.
Yeah, Meg Cheever has so much to be proud of building that over the course of 20-plus years.
Absolutely.
Of conservancy. I mentioned the success in Minneapolis, ranked number one 6 different times. You could have sat on your success, maybe.
I could have. You're right. Really honored that I was able to be the superintendent for the last 6 years. It was the number one park system. And we also accomplished a really historic agreement with the city, getting additional $250 million for our neighborhood parks for capital and maintenance investment. But I like challenges and I like, again, as I mentioned, doing work in cities to really bring parks to life and be the center of a city is really important. So I saw this as an incredible opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Anybody who has lived in the area for a while knows that we also have some wonderful county parks, mm-hmm. North, South, Hartwood Acres. I'm not going to name them all. But what's different? What's special about parks in an urban area, parks within our neighborhoods, our communities?
You know, so first of all, the fundamental basis of any urban park system is its neighborhood park system, mm-hmm. that are spaces that are in neighborhoods where people can walk their dogs, take their kids to play in a playground. And that's the heart and soul of any urban system. You look at what's happening in the country today, more people in the United States are living in urban areas than ever before. 83% of U.S. residents live within an urban area. And just like during the Industrial Revolution of the city, when urban growth started happening and the recognition of how incredible green space was for quality of life, for respite, the same is true today, that as we are building our urban core, what are we doing to ensure that we are providing green spaces to help with the environmental stewardship of a city, health and wellness for residents that live within the city, also providing drivers of economic development. But that quality of life that is so critical today. Millennials who graduate from college aren't just going to a job anymore. They are going to cities that provide excellent quality of life and then are finding jobs in those cities. So in order for Pittsburgh to compete with the best and brightest, we've got to have that quality of life here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I think, do you think it gets underplayed, the importance of parks and the quality of life? We say, okay, they want access to different amenities, they want a good mass transit, et cetera, but the importance of parks right practically next door to them.
Absolutely. I think that cities like Minneapolis got it early on. In fact, when Minneapolis was created, the park system was built first and the city was built around it. There are a few cities in the country who got it early on. Other cities today now get it because they're competing for the best and brightest. And they know having that quality green space is critical to getting businesses to come into towns, to get the young professionals to stay into a city. So I think cities are getting it today.
So does that mean they're more likely to invest in the park system?
That's what I'm seeing.
Okay.
That's exactly what I'm seeing. And that's part of what I'm hoping to accomplish here in Pittsburgh, is have greater investments in our parks.
You've been on the job for several months now. Have you visited all the city parks?
No, I have not, but I am.
There are quite a few.
There's 165 parks in the city. We know the big regional parks, but I am fortunate that Mike Gable from the city, he and I are spending a considerable amount of time to go to every single park in the city. Mm-hmm. So I expect within the next couple of months, I will have hit all of them.
Okay. So how do you make sure that the smaller ones that really are there in, you know, this community and that community and practically every community, that they're not overlooked?
You know, it's easier to raise money for regional parks. It's much more difficult to do that for neighborhood parks. We've, the time that I've been here, we've completed assessment of all of the parks in the city, and we're about to embark on a parks listening tour where we're going to go to every single neighborhood to share the information we have on those parks and then to get input from the community about what they want in their investments for their neighborhood parks.
Let's talk a little bit more about the community input on that, on the neighborhood parks. And then how this ties into the investments you alluded to earlier. How do you make sure that those investments are equitable so it's not just in the regional ones, whether it is Frick or Highland or Schenley or Riverview?
Absolutely. So, you know, what we have done, we've collected data on all the park conditions and the investment needs in every single park for maintenance and capital. We've also looked within the 10-minute walk shed of every one of those parks, community characteristics like vacancy rate, crime, population density of seniors and youth. We've also looked at the health indicators such as obesity, diabetes, asthma, depression, and the environmental factors. So we'll take all of that data, share it with the public, and then we will ask the community, say, what are your priorities? Because we are simply the stewards of public land. And so it's our responsibility to make sure the investments are being made in the way that the community wants us to make them.
Investments, money. Tell us how. What are the main sources of funding for to keep our parks maintained and to upgrade them when need be?
Clearly, the city resources are about $30 million a year they spend on parks. RAD money is really critical. RAD, on the average over the last 20 years, has contributed about $7.4 million a year to the regional parks. And the Conservancy, on average over 20 years, has raised annually, has contributed $7.2 million a year. So significant amount of money, obviously, from the public sector, but also the private fundraising is critical to leverage additional resources, and actually is the reason why when the Trust for Public Land rated Pittsburgh in 2018, we jumped from 39 in 2017 to 23, because this was the first year they counted private money that was contributed to taking care of the park systems here.
Well, since you mentioned it, yes, a big jump, 16 spots in the rankings, and resources, facilities, acreage. Are there any other qualities that were cited to show Pittsburgh's park system jumping up in the rankings?
You know, they look at access, the percent of residents in a city that live within a 10-minute walk of a park. They look at median park size. They look at the types of facilities, and then they look at investments as well. The investment piece, as well as the facilities assets we have, were the reasons we jumped up. But most significantly, it was the private investment that was counted for the first time in the Trust for Public Lands ranking that really jumped Pittsburgh up 16 rankings.
Earlier, I mentioned the big city parks, including Frick. If you haven't been to the Frick, well, I know you have, but if the listeners have not been to the Frick Environmental Center, what an impressive facility that is. How difficult was it to achieve earlier this year the Living Building Challenge certification? What does that mean?
Yeah, so it obviously is. It's a very difficult piece. One of the things that's really critical for the Conservancy is that we invest in environmental sustainability in every project we have, and that we do it high quality. Excellence is really important. So when we built this building and raised the funds for the project, It was a platinum LEED certificated building, which is the highest LEED certification you can get. And we also wanted to get living building certification. So it's where we source our materials. They have to come within a certain radius of the city of Pittsburgh. We also have to produce our own energy. We also have to have our own water system, as well as a number of other factors. We have to operate that for at least a year at that level in order to qualify for living building certification. The Frick Environmental Center is only the 21st building in the entire world that has living building certification, and it is the only municipally owned building that is open to the public that gets the certification. We had over 100,000 visitors in the building since it's been open, and think about maintaining this living building status when you have that many people coming through a building. All the other ones are, they can control the number of people come in the building, and it's a much smaller number of people come in. So very, very proud of getting living building certification, given the standards we have to maintain.
When considering what that building actually replaced, a burned-down building from years ago. We have about 90 seconds left. First of all, congratulations. You're the new chair of the World Urban Park Board. So what do you apply from what you learned from your colleagues around the world and how that might be helpful to Pittsburgh?
Well, Kevin, one of the things that we just had our Congress in Australia this fall, and it's a gentleman by the name of Daniel Raven Ellison in London who is creating, who started this National Park City movement. And when we think about cities, we think about parks within them. Mm-hmm. But this National Park City movement is looking at the city in its entirety. And how do we look at it in terms of sustaining our environmental sustainability, not just through parks, but everything we do within the city? So taking a living building standard and, for example, not just doing in a park, but how can we do that in other buildings in the city, for example? What can we do to protect our environment? Things like that really puts the thought of park spaces on its head and thinking about it as a whole city.
Boy, that's an interesting concept. Parks leading the way.
Absolutely.
Last 30 seconds. So plan for next year, a five-year plan, you choose.
Well, we have a strategic plan to actually get more funding for parks, get a stronger agreement with the city for a public-private partnership, continue our work on environmental sustainability, and embed equity into our investments and the work that we do. So pretty aggressive plan, but I'm really excited. And 2019 and 2020 are going to be critical times for the park system here in Pittsburgh.
And you'll be breaking ground on a new extension, if you would, or refurbishing of the Northside Commons, right?
Absolutely. So Allegheny Commons, we're finishing up construction on a fountain with a grand opening next spring.
Very good. Jane Miller is the president and CEO of the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, the organization Hello Neighbor was founded after a successful, if unconventional, holiday meal shared between longtime Pittsburghers and people new to both the area and the nation. We'll hear how it's evolved since that first Turkey Day and what's in store for them next. And Pittsburgh was named one of the top cities in the nation for volunteerism. Those accolades are great, but what does it really mean for the dozens of organizations out there looking for consistent help? Find this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.FM/Confluence, on Twitter at @WESAConfluence, plus wherever you find your podcasts.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Allegheny County conducts an objective physiological test for air pollution for the first time in 1975. Researchers used a mobile monitoring station to measure air quality for 5 days. The area found to be the most polluted was the Clairton community due to its proximity to the Clairton Coke Works. Scientists say the pollution had negative effects on the region's weather. The study was used to implement air quality regulations and further research the health impact from environmental pollution. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Nearly 300 boys and girls are enrolled in the Northside Youth Athletic Association's football and cheering squads. Association President Gene Goodwine says the organization teaches kids a lesson that he wishes he'd learned as a young person about the importance of being a student first and athlete second. 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort spoke to Goodwine at Fowler Field on the north side.
I grew up in Northview Heights, which is a housing project about 5 minutes away from here. Up there, that's all we had. You know, that's all we had was sports. And it didn't matter where you went in Northview Heights, you seen kids playing sports. That was our outlet. We didn't have much, but we knew we can have a football, basketball, or baseball. We had some powerful adults who head up our teams that came up out of Northview. And once I seen how my coaches actually cared about us and you know, like we stayed the night at their house before games and after games. And, you know, once I seen that, it was like something that was instilled in me. So when I was of age to do it, it was like second nature. I mean, this is all I knew. The guys that I looked up to, this is what they did.
You do it now with even additional motivation, that a lesson that you learned, that sports isn't everything, that you really have to do more than just be a good athlete.
Because with me, you know, I didn't get the student part. You know, I just thought, athlete, I'll go somewhere if I'm an athlete. I didn't know that you had to control a certain grade point average, SAT scores and stuff like that. So we start teaching our youth, our young athletes, boys and girls, you're a student first, you're athlete second. And we start instilling that into their minds at 5 and 6 years old. We believe that by the time they get to high school, their focus will be, I got to get my books first so I can be on the field or on the court. We just believe that we have to start showing them that they can get just as many awards for academics as you can for athletics.
How do you inspire them to do their best, both on the field and in the classroom and at home and in their community?
When you build relationships with the youth, especially when you build them at such a young age, you become a father figure to them, you know, in some instances. You know, some instances you might be a big brother to them. Those are all people that you don't want to disappoint, you know. So it's like when they're on the field, you know, they're playing for their teammates, you know, because that's one thing that you do preach, you know, you're playing for the guy to the left of you, to the right of you. At the same time, you know, they're playing for their coaches. You know, some of these kids, they look at these coaches like they're a superstar. So it's like when they're out there playing, you know, and if they do mess up and you do get on them, it's like, you know, they don't want that. They don't want to disappoint you. It's pretty easy to motivate them in that instance once you build a relationship with them. Every so often, you know, you get a kid or two that come back that came through the program and they say thank you. For us, it's like this is what we do, you know, but for them, it's like you might have saved them. There might have been one or two things you might have said, and it changed their whole outlook on things. Those are the things that keep me coming down here.
Thank you very much, Gene Goodwine, for taking time to do this interview.
Thank you. Thank you.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When immigrant and refugee families arrive in Pittsburgh, there are bound to be many, many questions about everyday life. Sloan Davidson is the founder and CEO of Hello Neighbor, a Pittsburgh-based mentorship program which helps these new residents find their social footing. Welcome, Sloan. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the holidays are drawing near, and I understand that really that Hello Neighbor was at least inspired by a personal experience you had around the holidays.
It certainly was. It was 2 years ago in 2016. I had signed up through a program I just found online one evening to get matched with a refugee family to share a meal. I didn't hear anything or think much of it for a while. And I got a call 2 days before Thanksgiving. And the call said, "We found a family for you. Would you like to have them over for dinner?" And I said, "Thanksgiving is right around the corner. This would be perfect. Why don't I have them over for Thanksgiving dinner?" And then I paused and I remembered that I don't host Thanksgiving at my house. And so I had to make a phone call to my family, to my stepdad. And I called him and he picked up and I said, "I'm really excited about Thanksgiving in 2 days. By the way, can I bring 5 people I've never met, who don't speak much English? They're from Syria. I don't know anything else really about them." And he said, let me call you right back. But he did call me right back. And he said a phrase from the Bible, a lot of people know, fishes and loaves,
right.
And really spoke to sharing with me that you're giving us the opportunity to be the kind of Pittsburghers, the kind of Americans that we say we want to be, that we talk about. How could we possibly say no? And from that experience, welcoming a Syrian family into our homes for Thanksgiving, I created a very real and authentic friendship with that family, started spending more time with them. They came to my son's first birthday party. We shared a meal at their house. And from that experience, I started talking about it to other friends and family, and people wanted to have what I was experiencing. And I started looking around to try and find something like what I was envisioning in my head and what I was having with this family. I couldn't find it, so I started it myself.
Well, it's interesting. One can open one's home for a meal and say, oh, that was a great experience, and that's it. But the mentorship program goes so much farther. What exactly does it involve, and in how you partner Pittsburghers with new Pittsburghers one-on-one, or one on a family, mm-hmm. I should say.
Exactly right, because it is what I call peer-based mentoring. So it could be on the Pittsburgh side, an individual, a couple, a family. We have a lot of families with kids under 18 in the home themselves. We have empty nesters, retirees. And what we really do is we match one-on-one that Pittsburgher, individual, couple, or family with a refugee family. We currently have families from 12 different countries enrolled in the program, and we go out into the community and we talk to the refugee families about what this program would be for them. We talk to them about the social isolation that they face. It's very real, similar to the social isolation of seniors, where, you know, a lot of people just don't get out. It's hard for new families to know about Pittsburgh. And so one of the goals of Hello Neighbor is to make them more comfortable and confident in their new lives here. And we do that in a variety of ways. These matches come together and they might have life skills, help with school, job, apartment, but we also just want to get them out of their homes and experiencing Pittsburgh. And that's where it comes in. We'll take them to the libraries, to different museums around the city, really just to experience Pittsburgh and feel more confident here.
In fact, you started just your third cohort, as you called them.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big outing you were telling me about.
That's right. So we are 18 months old, and we do run the mentorship cohort style, which means we launch about 20 to 30 matches at a time. That allows us to bring everyone together for one big orientation. That allows us to have this cohort come together as a pop-up community. So we all get to have a lot of different experiences together and spend a lot of time together. The mentors get to know each other, the mentee families. It's a really wonderful experience. And during each cohort, we do a few what we call signature experiences. And these are opportunities to take all of the families out to different places around Pittsburgh. And I have to tell you, all of the Pittsburgh cultural institutions have just been tremendous at opening their doors and wanting to be so welcoming to these refugees who have gone through so much and are rebuilding their lives. So right now, we just took everyone recently to the Carnegie Science Center. It was quite a day of seeing 160, 170 people from our program exploring the museum. We've also gone to the Andy Warhol Museum, the Children's Museum, Heinz History. We've gone to the Riverhounds and the Pirates, mm-hmm. and trips on the Gateway Clipper, along with River Life sponsoring that tour. So anywhere in Pittsburgh that's a really great place for families to go, we want to take our families there.
I'm sure the kids, the new young Pittsburghers are having a great time with us.
They're having a great time. And I have to tell you, regardless of English, so many of the children love math. Math is a language that's universal. And so a place like the Science Center was tremendous. All of the robotics, all of the right. STEAM and STEM that was there, the kids just had a blast.
So what special skills does an individual mentor or a mentor family need?
I would say a desire to give back and give of their time. What we ask for in the initial mentorship is a 6-month commitment, about 10 hours per month. It equals to about maybe one visit a week, maybe one every other. We do a lot of these group events, like I mentioned, so we try and help people decide what to do. But really the core for a lot of our mentors that they have told me time and time again is they want to do something real. I think in a digital, connected, always on society, we're always online, but yet how much do we know about our neighbors and our own community? And I look at a program like Hello Neighbors, rebuilding the fabric, both with our new neighbors, but just overall across Pittsburgh. I think there's something really beautiful when we do step out of our door and welcome somebody else and show them some of our favorite things in Pittsburgh or our favorite things to do. But really, it's just, I think, an authentic wanting to spend time and helping somebody who's putting their footing back together.
How much is it socialization as compared to maybe life skill development or just information to help in the daily lives?
It's really half and half. And I do it that way on purpose. I think that the refugee families, and again, 12 different countries, every culture is incredibly different. Their experiences are very different. Their time spent as refugees and the amount of time that they've spent trying to resettle in a third country is very different. But across the board, they have certain life skills, things they need. We do ask to couple that with other fun experiences. So a mentor family might take the refugee family to a playground or to a library to sign up for a library card and experience a story time. They might come back, and the refugee family might have a stack of mail that they're having a hard time reading and processing. Or they might have received a phone call, a voicemail from the school and not be able to understand it. Right. So I tend to say it's really important to put those two things together because that's what life is. It's a blend, right? It's a little bit of the hard stuff and it's a little bit of the fun stuff. And I really wanted Hello Neighbor to be able to put both together.
And you don't have to understand the language. You have translators.
Well, that's really interesting you would mention that. So we do have interpreters on the Hello Neighbor team. We offer interpretation at very key moments, so at the in-home introduction when everyone first meets. But beyond that, we really tell the mentors to and the mentees to work a lot of it out themselves. That can sound a little scary and daunting, but I would share with you that, you know, we work closely with Literacy Pittsburgh, and a lot of language, they're the leading, ESL teacher in the city, and they would say that a lot of language is actually not verbal. It's, you know, eye contact, it's things that you can see and looking at somebody. And one of the things to me that is very core and important to Hello Neighbor is I say you can share an experience with somebody and not need to necessarily share a language. So by sharing a meal, by going out and doing something, by doing an art project or a craft or something with music, you can really get to know someone. You might not be able to sit across from someone at the table like you and I are doing now and have a very in-depth conversation. Or you might, again, depending on the country and where the people are from. But I find that the language gets easier over time and people make their way through. And I also think it's a really good reminder. A lot of these families, they're learning English and they're trying. And so we should try the other side. We should be a little forgiving on the other side to make it work.
And again, how long does the mentorship last?
The initial commitment we talk about is 6 months. It was really important to have that initial curation. So we have the events. We do a lot of back and forth with mentors and mentees to make sure the relationship is coming together really well. But what I have found is that after that 6 months, a lot of the relationships are continuing on. And I imagine they will go for years and years, if not lifelong friendships. And that really is what they become. They become friends. They act like an extended family. We have mentors who have been invited to weddings and baby namings and birthday parties and big celebrations. And so we celebrate the good and we help work through the challenges. And I really believe that the mentors, after that initial 6 months, they have the grounding and the footing to be able to go for a very long time.
Sloan Davidson is the founder and CEO of Hello Neighbor, a nonprofit mentoring program for immigrant and refugee families. Sloan, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Sometimes when we are asked to contribute, it's easier to donate money. But what about when we are asked, just offer without even being asked, to give of ourselves, our time? A new study by the Corporation of National Community Service indicates that Pittsburgh is the number 7 city in the country for volunteering. We're going to talk about that spirit of volunteerism with Riley Baker, director of the Retired Senior Volunteer Program. Welcome to the Confluence, Riley.
Good morning, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me.
And it's wonderful to have you here. So before we talk about the role of your organization when it comes to volunteering in our region, what's your take on volunteerism in our area, willingness to do so? Who's putting themselves out there?
That's a great question, Kevin. And I would say I'm happy, thrilled, in fact, to report on the findings of the study done by the Corporation for National and Community Service. But let's bring it a little bit more locally and say, yeah, volunteering is healthy here in Pittsburgh, in Allegheny County, and the southwestern PA region in general. I would say that certainly there is always the need for an individual to step up and say, how can I make a difference? How can I make an impact in my community? But that said, in a number of different ways, whether it's formal or informal, Pittsburghers are providing of their time and talent.
All ages, or the people that tend to have a little more time on their hand, retirees, or is it coming across all age groups?
Sure. Well, it really does come across all age groups, but there are some distinct differences between how different demographics volunteer. You asked specifically about retirees and seniors, of something I can speak on directly as I am the director of the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program, so I know something about this. And right there, we've got two generations, really, that are volunteering at the 55 and up age demographic. One, we've got potentially the greatest generation, who we might think of when we think of a senior volunteer. But what I would say is, and a word of caution, is maybe also take that image and now include this incoming wave of baby boomers that are hitting the volunteer scene and really looking to get involved and get involved in a way that's different from how their parents volunteered. They want to volunteer a little bit more directly with the clients that they're working with. They want to roll up their sleeves and get their hands dirty. They'd like to take their professional expertise and apply it directly to the nonprofit world in a way where they're using their professional skill sets to make a difference in their community.
So using their skill sets, hands-on work, hands-on volunteering. What's the range of volunteer work that you've been seeing? Are we talking about animal shelters, homeless shelters, food banks, what?
Yeah, so I have a great job because from my perspective, I get to see all this volunteering happening across the spectrum. So yes, we have the things that you would currently think of as typical volunteering, maybe at animal shelters or at the soup kitchen, so forth like this. However, we also see volunteers going out, cleaning up our riverfronts, putting on the galoshes, pulling up cars out of the river. We see really wonderful volunteers helping maintain our urban forest. We see volunteers dedicating a couple hours of their time each week to mentoring young people. Some of the youth mentoring programs that are happening here in the region are really, really inspiring. I believe on the show earlier, we were talking about ways that a potential volunteer can help the refugee community. So here we see a number of different ways that people are getting involved, whether it's literally rolling up their sleeves and getting their hands dirty, or stepping into communities that need the impact and applying their time and talent in a way that addresses that need in a strategic way.
You mentioned a couple of generations and how they're volunteering. So what are the traditional ways that Pittsburghers have volunteered? How do those ways reflect just who we are?
Yeah, this is a really great question that I think a lot about. Pittsburgh is, in many ways, typical for what we see according to research as to how people traditionally volunteer. But what I would say is, in getting to that question on how does this reflect who we have been, some of this might seem straightforward and simple, but we volunteer through our communities, through our neighborhoods, and what have been the traditional hearts of neighborhoods, oftentimes churches. So traditionally, Pittsburghers would go to their faith community to find out where their needs and talents should be applied. And of course, word of mouth, this type of thing. Pittsburghers have always been generous with helping out their neighbors, period. Now, that said, we are also certainly seeing trends change. Technology has absolutely made a big impact with how we find our volunteering opportunities. Being able to log on to a website like PittsburghCares.org, where one can research on their own and find things outside of maybe their neighborhood that are more akin to what their personal interests or what they've been called to passion-wise, to really sort of customize and find that niche opportunity to volunteer. So that has really changed that central dynamic, but those two elements work very well together, and I would say are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
It's interesting because you have the satisfaction of helping others, one type of volunteering. You mentioned something else, say cleaning up of the hillside. Every spring or something, there's organizations that sort of put together crews to do that. And that's something that not only you're volunteering, but you're also... we're all benefiting from that, a cleaner environment.
Right. That's a really good point. And I will say that work is never going to go away. There's always going to be work to be done. But let me just say for a moment that volunteerism is not 100% altruistic. It does not have to be. We all can look at volunteering as a way to get something out of this experience, not just for the community's need, but for ourselves. Some people volunteer, maybe they're between jobs and they'd like to pad out their resume, provide an answer to that gap. Others are looking to expand on skill sets that they might not necessarily have at this point. Another great way to volunteer. And a lot of people volunteer socially. It's a great way to meet other people with like-minded interests that have maybe the same value set that you have and are willing to get in the community and do something about it.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Has volunteering become sort of more coordinated? In other words, more companies, businesses partnering with nonprofits to have the company's workers volunteer to help that nonprofit, whether it's for incentives or not?
Yes, and this is a growing trend, and we love it. And we heartily encourage any companies, corporations to join with us to help provide their employee base with meaningful opportunities to volunteer. It's a win-win situation for everyone. The company gets to have the opportunity to interact with their employees in a way that's outside of their typical setting. A lot of times this can be looked at as like professional development. And then employees get that opportunity to, through work, give back in a way that makes them understand and know that their companies do care about the communities that we exist in and are willing to invest in the time for their employees to partake.
All right. So with more boomers retiring every day, there's 10,000 people across this nation hit 65 every day. It sounds like the Retired Senior Volunteer Program might have a big pool for years to come.
It certainly would seem that way, and we are thrilled and would love to invite anyone listening to check out the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program. It's a free opportunity provided by the Corporation for National and Community Service, and we provide customized volunteer placement for anyone interested in getting involved. So, yeah, we've got this great pool, and it's up to us to lean on each other to say, hey, let's get this word out about how we can make a difference in our community, because it is so important. I think, you know, one final note I'll say is that I think currently what I'm seeing when people come to me is a certain level of anxiety with the state of the world. Mm-hmm. And getting involved locally, being able to have some effect on something within our sphere of influence can really help with that sort of greater anxiety around what can I do? How can I make a difference? So if you are the type of person that might be feeling that and you're at a point in your life where you have a little bit more time and treasure to give, please consider service. Please consider volunteerism.
Last 30 seconds. What is it for the person that hasn't volunteered before to take that next step?
Sure. Visit us at PittsburghCares.org, www.PittsburghCares.org. We're a one-stop shop to find out about hundreds of nonprofits that we partner with within the area to find that perfect volunteering opportunity.
And you'll find a match.
We will. Absolutely.
All right. Riley Baker is the director of the Retired Senior Volunteer Program. Riley, thanks so much for coming in.
Kevin, thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a report card grades Pennsylvania's infrastructure on everything from roads and bridges to water, schools, and parks. Plus, a state Senate race is still undecided, and now a lawsuit has been filed. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli and Meg Fair. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.